welcome to Book Tales with Fran Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Leanne Rorapaugh, author of Reveal Codes, published by Moon City Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a great idea. Today, we are drinking a meringue head inspired by Lee's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Leanne Rorapaugh is a biracial Nisei and the author of 5 volumes of poetry, most recently Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50, which was named a best book of 2019 by the New York Public Library, selected as a poetry finalist in the 2020 Lambda Literary Awards, and named one of the 50 must-read poetry collections in 2019 by Book Riot. Her collection of fiction, Reveal Codes, was selected as a winner of the Moon City Press Short Fiction Award, and their chapbook, String of Beads, a winner in the Diode Editions chapbook competition in 2023. She was a 1998 winner of the National Poetry Series, the winner of the Association of Asian American Studies Book Award in Poetry/Prose for 2004, and the South Dakota State Poet Laureate from 2015 through 2019. Rorapaugh is a professor of English at the University of South Dakota, where they serve as editor-in-chief of South Dakota Review. Of the story collection we feature today, Reveal Codes, author Michael Nye says, quote, "The stories in Leanne Rorapaugh's Reveal Codes are filled with disappointed parents and disconnected lovers, revealed with a poet's precision for the language of heartbreak and longing. Each story closes with a scene that will expand the reader's heart, lingering long after the moment ends. This is a wondrous collection of stories from a writer who animates ordinary lives with extraordinary force and grace." End quote. Great praise.
Reveal Codes is a collection of short stories mapping the way in which people and other animals read and misread, communicate and miscommunicate, mask and unmask, with and around one another. In the abandonware word processing program WordPerfect, Reveal Codes is the command that reveals the coding behind the face of a document. The stories in this collection spiral around a biosemiology of the multiplicities of desire. In a series of pas de deux or duets, the characters in these stories try to make themselves legible to family, friends, and lovers, revealing their messy patterns, their barefaced vulnerabilities. These are stories that unfurl tentacles of longing made with language in an attempt to decode the illegibility of an incoherent and inchoate surrounding world.
I'm so excited to talk about this book today. How are you doing today, Lee?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm in Wyoming, and it's a cold and sunny day, and the vice grip of a difficult semester is starting to loosen up a little bit. So,
Awesome. Well, we are so looking forward to talking with you about your work, but also having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I think that there's something that brings a work to life when it's alive and in the air and kind of existing in time and space as well as on the page.
How did this book come to be? Can you tell us about that? Where you got the idea for it? And at what point did you know it was going to be a collection?
I've always been very interested in questions of communication and miscommunication. My mother was a first-generation immigrant and not a native speaker of English. So in my poetry, I've thought a lot about the ways in which things are translated or mistranslated and the kind of difficulties of language or the ways in which we really kind of desire to connect with one another as humans. And I've always been interested in biosemiotics, the ways that animals or insects sort of communicate with one another. So that's always been an obsession of mine, I think. And so I wanted to kind of think how this might work in fiction. It was something I dealt with in poetry, but I wanted to see what might happen if I brought it into a more narrative format and kind of looking at these sort of situations of people reaching out or trying to reach out or trying to communicate with one another. And so the first story in the collection, Date, was sort of a thank you story. It came very easily in a matter of hours. And at that point, I had that feeling of sort of the pacing or the sort of style, and several other stories then followed very quickly. And I think at that point, I knew that I'd kind of latched on the format for the kinds of stories that I wanted to be in this collection.
Interesting.
I love that. Is there a difference in the way that you approach something when you're coming on writing it? In other words, do you know immediately when something is a poem or a story? And how does this prose impulse fit in what you see as your overall trajectory?
That's such a great question. I mean, I think that genres tend to be arbitrary, that they're sometimes based on structures that have more to do with the publishing marketplace than actual art or aesthetic choices. So sometimes as writers, I think we need to follow our instincts and then let a piece reveal itself to us as being a poem or an essay or a short story. But I think that for me, I've always wanted to write fiction. I find fiction the most difficult, maybe for me, of all of the genres, perhaps the less instinctive. And maybe there's something about fiction where I feel like the stitches or the seams show a little bit more. And so it's maybe the most artificial of the genres, yet it has to create an illusion of authenticity or reality. So I find it a really interesting kind of challenge. But I think that there are circumstances or stories or narratives or things that I overhear or things I kind of notice about people that I see or my friends that don't ever quite fit into a poem and are also maybe not quite appropriate for the essays that I like to write. And so that to me is usually kind of a hint that this is something that could be brought into the texture or the frame of a short story.
I love that idea. I noticed that a lot of your characters in the stories are nameless. We've got the plagiarist, meringue head, the beloved, neurotic cat boy. And I was curious about what was behind your decision to leave these characters unnamed. To me, it seemed connected to the narrator's sort of resistance to let down their wall, a way to distance people almost in their lives, which for me was also a theme in the collection. But I was just kind of interested in that.
It is interesting because it is a little bit of a distancing device. Also, perhaps maybe kind of a privacy scrim as well. But I find naming characters, frankly, difficult. I mean, if you name a character Fred, sometimes all of the weird nuance or complexity of that character maybe doesn't fit in the receptacle of Fred. Yet, I think when I use a descriptor as name, it sort of feels simultaneously a little bit more accurately pointed than a name like Fred, but perhaps it also gives a larger umbrella for some of the complexity and weirdness and specificity of a character to come to life. So I feel like sometimes descriptor as name maybe does more for me than sort of a standard name. But I also find naming characters really difficult. I mean, it feels like the name can sometimes limit a character in my mind.
I do too. I find it very difficult and I don't think I'm great at it.
I love that. And I think that it's so intriguing because on the one hand, it's very distancing, but on the other hand, it's almost like you're learning a secret in somebody's mind about that type of person in general. So it also brings you more intimate with the thinker, sort of in a weird way, if that makes any sense. I was very interested how the collection was moving in the ideas and issues of gender and sexuality. And I thought that that was so cool about this book was that it had some more diverse representation than we generally see for female identified characters, for example. And I thought it was done in a really really fresh and modern way. Do you think exposure to students in your program director role at USD or awareness of the much more gender fluid, open tendencies of Gen Z could be creating an openness in the publishing environment and journal environment for more diverse representation of sex positivity in female and non-binary narrators?
I really hope so. I mean, I think that's so exciting about the younger generations in the ways that they are so much more fluent in different nuances of gender identity, the ways in which they are more fluent in the different possibilities that are open in terms of sexual orientation or ways of being sexual in the world. And there's something so positive about that. In so many ways, I feel like the younger generations articulate senses that I had of being a woman or a sexual person or non-binary person in the world, yet it wasn't languaged yet, you know? So instead, it was more of a sense of how I wanted to be, also kind of butting up very firmly against ways in which I was told I should be or had to be. And those shoulds and hads never felt comfortable. And so in this moment where these different kinds of possibilities are opening up and are being languaged and discussed, it's a very exciting time, I think.
Oh, definitely. Though not all the stories are linked. There are some with a few repeat characters in them. And I was wondering about the story with the beloved that had you keep returning to that. And also when it came time to organize the stories, what was your process for that?
I wanted a sense of interconnectivity. While I wouldn't call this a story cycle or a novel in stories in any way, I did want a sense of cohesiveness. And so the stories with the beloved, I wanted to act like kind of support beams in perhaps implying a larger interconnected narrative that could be returned to several times and then sort of create the sense of connection, like everything sort of falling under the same roof with these particular stories functioning as support beams. I organized the collection very much the way that I organize a poetry collection as well, in terms of thinking about questions of texture, so that stories that might feel a bit too similar, aren't too closely together, but then trying to create hopefully surprising or interesting textual juxtapositions in terms of the ways in which I place one story next to another. And then using the story of the beloved sort of unfolding perhaps in a more linear way to have the sense of movement or momentum in time and space over the course of the collection.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by texture, the texture of a story, for maybe some of the new writers who are listening in?
Absolutely. I think about texture as being like color or a different feel or a different narrator. So putting stories next to one another where maybe the protagonist's gender is different, or if I have a story about the beloved, then a story about a character who is very different, making sure that the length of story or the tone is a little bit different. And so it's sort of an act of weaving. So thinking about colors, or maybe like the nubbliness of the yarn or the sparkliness, and making sure that it feels balanced, but there's also difference in between one story to the next.
Such a cool way to think about it, and the impact that it's going to have on the reader just by the way that you place one story next to the other.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I noticed that texture was coming in too with the age of the characters. So that was really interesting, the kind of way that different generations were coming in and coming out. And this kind of harks back to something you said a little bit earlier about, I don't know, preconceived notions of what you should be or had to be, that I think different generations feel differently about in terms of possibly the intensity of parenting or the expectation of parents. And that was another thing that I loved that came through this book a lot. It felt like the segments of the book that talk about the parental role are really shaping the reaction of the younger characters who are then making choices in their lives. And so one of my favorite stories in this book is the one that's called Sundowning with Fat Juice. That story is great. I actually was like laughing out loud and kind of surprised because I thought, I'm reading a serious collection. Oh, but this one is hilarious. This one is great. Great, but in the way of the best humor, also layered and nuanced with intense, deeper undercurrents that are creating the complexity in the humor. And for me, it was kind of showing the narrator's nuclear family and the last gasp of a long suffering marriage between two elderly characters and the way that they were interacting with their adult daughter. In this case, there were like long-term resentments that clash with deep connections between all the parties, but many of the other characters in other stories, I noticed, are leaving bad relationships or trying to escape strict roles modeled by their nuclear families. So I wondered when I got there, was this the piece de resistance thematically for you that exposed maybe the danger of staying too long in a bad dynamic, or possibly the subtextual motivation for some other characters maybe who witnessed how toxic love creates flight impulses in children to vary their paths from parental models?
Absolutely. Thank you for that wonderful and really insightful reading. I mean, I think that if one comes from a toxic or an abusive family of origin, there's so many things that one doesn't learn how to do, including communicate mm-hmm. effectively with one's partners. I think communication is something that you learn or needs to be taught. And if there isn't vulnerable or honest or open communication in your family of origin, then it kind of comes down to a matter of trial and error in terms of how you learn to communicate with other people, in particular, intimate partners or lovers. But I think also then if you're coming from a toxic or an abusive family of origin, then frequently part of the trial and error too is the pitfall of initially being drawn to toxic relationships that mirror a false notion of what love or intimacy is or looks like. And, you know, sometimes having to repeat that cycle several times and then trying to figure out ways to move away from those foundational but also very damaging patterns.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I mean, love is hard enough, even if you had a positive role model for it, right? But when you have to create a model outside of your experience and or become it or make it out of nothing, that I'm sure is even harder. Yeah, I found that fascinating in the story, the way that intimacies came together and fell apart, both in that story and in all of them, actually. It's such a really cool telescoping in on intimate relationships. So thank you for that. I loved that about this collection.
Thank you.
I love the collection too. There were so many great stories in it, so many favorites. And I know this is like asking someone if they have a favorite child, but I was wondering, do you have a favorite story in the collection?
I really like Sundowning with Fat Juice, which was one of, I think that was actually maybe the last story that I wrote for the collection, even though it's not actually the last story in the manuscript. And it's interesting because it's a story that I felt very uncomfortable with. It's one of the stories that perhaps is closest to some of my own personal experiences. So I think part of it is the story felt vulnerable, but it was also, it felt like a tricky story because in many ways, it's kind of about a dark or intense time or topic, you know, aging parents that need to be moved into assisted living and their marriage is sort of filled with resentments, kind of having to come home and parent parents who were never fully capable of actually parenting the speaker. At the same time, I wanted it to be funny because there's a kind of absurdity in so many of the narrative details. And so I wanted it to kind of hit that balance between darkness and intensity as well as humor, but trying to hit that balance and hit it right felt like a challenge.
challenge. And it was also something I was very worried about if it would work or not. So it's a story that I've come to really like a lot. I'm also particularly fond of Date, which is the first story in the manuscript. And it was the first story I wrote for this collection. And I think that because it sort of happened so easily, I had been at an artist residency in Banff and I was working on the poems from Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50 and also some essays, but I was getting ready to fly home from Canada and I'm at this hotel near the airport in Calgary, getting ready to fly out the next day. And I got on my laptop and the story sort of happened magically. And for me, it kind of formed the lens or the starting point, I think, from which all of the other stories ended up emerging in one way or another.
That is so cool. And I love that story, by the way. I think you did an amazing job with it. What I'm wondering, because you have such a diversity of what you turn out, is there some sort of awesome challenge project that you might be very excited to write? Are there any books or ideas that maybe have been culminating for years or styles or genres you'd like to try?
I recently have been working on what I think is a novel in verse about a giant octopus that might be real or might be virtual. But it's also very much engaged in the genre of climate fiction and sort of thinking through the question of what, you know, may or may not be the age of pandemics and then also climate change and sort of thinking through the ways in which these elements are unraveling. And so I'm really fascinated by climate fiction. I'm fascinated by speculative fiction. And so, yeah, I think I'm working on a novel in verse and it's fun and it's exciting, but it's also very intimidating as well.
Sounds really exciting.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm ready to read it right now. I mean, tomorrow, email. That sounds amazing. And also, it sounds very visual and cool. And for a weird moment, I was thinking, how cool would that be if you write it this way? But it could also potentially be a filmic thing, right? You could end up seeing it made into something visual in that way as well. Once you've written something, it's amazing how many different ways it can translate or morph, right? I don't know if you've had this experience, but... Yeah. So this is great. Well, we're looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Reveal Codes. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Meringue Head, named after a character in the first story in the collection. The recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 2 ounces of gin, 3/4 ounce of simple syrup, 1/2 ounce of heavy cream, 1 ounce lemon juice, freshly squeezed, 3 dashes of orange flower water, and 1 fresh egg white. A little bit of club soda, chilled, that you're going to use to top the drink. To make it, you add the gin, simple syrup, heavy cream, lemon juice, orange flower water, and egg white into a shaker without ice and dry shake it for about 30 seconds. Then you add ice and shake for 20 more seconds or until well chilled and strain into a Collins glass. You top it with a splash of soda and garnish with a strip of lemon peel. And you can also use alcohol-free gin if you want to make it zero proof.
This sounds so exciting. I want to make this like a science experiment.
If I do say so myself.
I know, right? I want to drink this. I want to see it. I want to viscerally experience making it. It seems like it's very fun. So would you like to tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
I think that I will read Date, which goes along with the fabulous Meringue Head cocktail. And this is a story that I like to think of as being a braided story. I'm very much sort of interested in different forms, and I'm attracted to the fluidity of forms in poetry or lyric essay. And that was one of the things I wanted to do in the collection, was perhaps borrow some of these interesting forms or structures. And so this is called Date, and it has 3 strands or 3 different dates that are being woven together to kind of think through these pairings or these dances. Date. Fuji Bay in Sioux City, slow Monday night, and the Bachelorette's on TV. She stopped on her way back from the airport in an attempt to self-soothe with sushi. Earlier in the day, she said goodbye to the beloved in a different airport,
then dozed on and off through two uncomfortable legs. Saying goodbye to the beloved is always dreadful. She feels it coming on as early as the day before, a red spread of despair like acid on litmus. And by the time they arrive at the airport, her chest is clenched into a tight fist of misery, and she feels sick to her stomach. On the flat screen mounted high in the corner behind the hostess stand and cash register, a woman in a shiny dress sits in candlelight at an outdoor table with a man whose head is meringued with too much hair product. Shiny dress's blonde hair riffles as if to infer the presence of an ocean breeze somewhere slightly off camera. Meringue head says something awful to shiny dress. She can tell it's awful by the way shiny dress's smile slides off her face and falls into her salad like a sad little crescent of avocado. She can tell by the way shiny dress, bless her heart, attempts to save face by pretending to laugh, by continuing to flirt, even though her eyes are now somewhere else, turned inside herself, maybe. They are the eyes of something crouching, something watchful and vigilant. She's glad the sound's turned down so that she isn't able to hear the awful thing Meringue Head has said to Shiny Dress. The restaurant is empty, except for a couple seated to her left. The man wears a blue Anderson heating and cooling shirt. The woman has a red tattoo on her forearm that says, Trust. When Trust gets up to use the restroom, she notices there's a man's face tattooed on Trust's shoulder blade. Dark-haired, Latinx, mustached. She can't tell if the face belongs to Anderson Heating and Cooling or not. She wonders which thing is more awkward, having your face tattooed on your lover's back, or having another man's face tattooed on your lover's back. On the way back from the restroom, Trust meets her eyes and breaks into a wide grin. Sometimes she comes unraveled at the airport, sobbing, causing a small scene in the terminal. A brief moment of diversion for bored travelers otherwise tractor-beamed into their cell phones. Sometimes the beloved cries too. In general, she disapproves of unrestrained crying at sights of mass transportation. In fact, there are airports she now feels compelled to avoid due to excessive displays of emotion. Sometimes the beloved, who is not a good flyer, shuts down and takes a Klonopin. Sometimes she tries to pick a fight with him when he has shut down and taken a Klonopin. But trying to fight with the beloved at the airport when he has shut down and taken a Klonopin is like fighting with tofu. Lately, she simply accepts his offerings of coffee or scones or croissants and tries to remain calm. It's not that she no longer feels like a wild trapped bird is trying to beat its way out from inside her chest. It's that it's simply too exhausting to allow herself to become emotionally scooped out to that degree. Like a honeydew melon balled down to its very rind. On The Bachelorette, Shiny Dress and Meringue Head ostentatiously toast each other, then drink in unison from their wine glasses. Meringue Head leans in for a kiss. She doesn't think that Shiny Dress should necessarily kiss Meringue Head, and as kisses go, it looks staged. Junior high kids playing spin the bottle and clumsily sucking face. Wanting to be seen in the act of kissing, as opposed to necessarily wanting to kiss the person they're kissing. Shiny Dress and Meringue Head confer for a moment, then awkwardly kiss some more. After that, they get up from the table and walk off set, holding hands. Shiny Dress's heels are too high, so that she gives the impression of simultaneously clumping and limping. Trust has ordered sunomono with jellyfish to start, and the waitress brings out a small bowl of hot rice to Anderson Heating and Cooling. He liberally pours a salty spiral of soy sauce over the steaming white grains, then eats it with a spoon and the kind of attentive relish that makes the rice look delicious. They sip their cold Sapporos, and soon the waitress arrives with a platter of norimake, Philly rolls, and dynamite rolls. At the airport, the beloved says that now, more than ever, he feels a particular urgency to address his situation. His situation is how he talks about his marriage. The other person is how he refers to his wife. He used to refer to his wife as his then-wife, but since she felt compelled to point out how misleading this was, he now calls his wife the other person. He says he's going to get a realtor. She wonders how long it will take. After returning to his too many hours of work, to the daughters he parents with such care, to the other person who leaves chicken breasts in the trunk of their car until the maggots arrive, for him to succumb to the deadly torpors of his day-to-day existence. She wonders how soon it will be until he represses this particular conversation altogether. He's possibly the sweetest person alive, so part of her feels ashamed for having these thoughts. His sweetness is what makes him dangerous, though. He's the emotional equivalent of the La Brea tar pits, and so another part of her has learned to put on glamorous dark glasses and coolly observe the drowning of the mastodons from a safe distance behind cynicism's fence. Stray salmon roe bob in her soy sauce like translucent orange buoys, and she fishes them out with her chopsticks and pops them one by one into her mouth. Shiny dress and meringue head are now exaggeratedly cavorting on a beach somewhere. Shiny dress wears a tiny orange bikini. Dolphins are involved. It's like a Star Trek holodeck. She wants to sneer a little at shiny dress and meringue head, but really, she's probably just as much of a cliche. What would her reality show look like? She'd probably have to wander around all day wearing a scarlet letter while the villages pelted her with rotten produce. Her friends have started to become embarrassed on her behalf. Her Japanese mother likes to tell her that she should star on The Bachelorette, but only after being on The Biggest Loser. Her Japanese mother thinks this is hilarious. Anderson Heating and Cooling has a small transistor radio attached to his belt. It plays Mexican radio. Love songs. He nods his head and whistles along to the tunes. Occasionally, he sings parts of the songs out loud to Trust. When he does this, Trust laughs and sways in time to the music, snapping her fingers. She says goodbye to the beloved outside a pretzel stand at the Washington Dulles Airport. As soon as she saw the pretzel signs in the terminal, she knew he would pick out a pretzel for himself while she went in search of a latte. She liked watching how happy he was while eating his pretzel. He decides to go back and get a second pretzel before his plane boards. To calm his nerves, he says. He's broken into a cold sweat. He doesn't want to go back, he says. He's rocking a little and he's taken a Klonopin. She loves him more than anyone. Her last image of the beloved is of him standing underneath the neon pretzel sign. His worried face under a neon pretzel. The neon pretzel under a neon halo.
That was
awesome.
I was waiting to hear if there was more. That was so good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love hearing you read too. I could listen for hours. And I hope more readers engage with and go get this book.
I have one more question and then we're going to wrap up, I think. What have you learned on your path to becoming an author and what advice would you offer new writers?
I would offer new writers to read as widely and voraciously and diversely as possible, for starters. I think that, interestingly, as an author, one of the things that I've learned along the way is to be willing to give myself permission to do things, to try things, to not get too caught up in what I think might or might not be the quote unquote rules for how to write or how to publish or how to do the things that I want to do. So to trust one's instinct
first of all, but then also to be willing to really work and to be stubborn and relentless about revising and making the work be the best that it can be.
Absolutely. And right, at the end of the day, if someone's a writer and they want to keep being a writer, they have to know where the love is, right?
Yes.
I mean, they have to know what it is about doing the craft and creating the stories or making the thing that gives them some level of satisfaction, because success and failure is kind of variable, right?
Oh, it's completely arbitrary. That's the thing that you don't have control over. You have control over what you make or that you continue to make and the ways in which you try to make yourself a better maker. But the external things, you never have any control over whatsoever.
Oh, is that true? Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We love talking with you and hearing you read your work.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
It was amazing. And everyone, please order Leanne Rorapaw's book, Reveal Codes, if you love collections of short fiction that make you think. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. And be sure to check out our new 6 co-host podcast series,
Heat,
Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. Also, subscribe to Book Tales, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.